On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, 10 declared Republican presidential contenders and Mother Nature took the stage in New Hampshire. There was thunder and lightning and plenty of debate. On Iraq, John McCain went after a Democrat.
What Senator Clinton doesn't understand, that presidents don't lose wars, political parties don't lose wars, nations lose wars.
On immigration, Rudy Giuliani went after the work of McCain.
The problem with this immigration plan is it has no real unifying purpose. It's a typical Washington mess.
And on abortion, Kansas Senator Sam Brownback went after Giuliani.
I have great respect for the mayor. I don't think we're going to nominate somebody that's not pro-life.
This hour, On Point, we'll lay out the Republican debate and look at who's making headway in the GOP battle. Joining us from Washington right now is Diane Furstgott-Roth, columnist for the New York Sun, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. She's worked for George W. Bush, who took his lumps last night. Diane, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And with me in the studio, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Diane.
Diana, first to you, what did you see on that stage last night?
Well, what I saw was basically quite a lot of dissonance among the candidates. In particular, immigration. I think it's very sad that John McCain is the only one standing up for a reasonable immigration policy. I think it's just unreasonable to think that we can make 12 million people just leave our country and have them vanish as by magic. And we need to think about seriously how we're going to integrate them or what we need to do. And the immigration bill put out by the Senate is a good place at least to start the debate.
There was a lot more back and forth here on policy than among the Democrats. Is that a good thing for the Republicans or not?
Well, I think it's always a good thing to be hashing these things out. Discussion is always good, but I think that we need to be realistic. We need to see that Iran is an enemy. We need to see that we need to do something about immigration. And there was less consensus on that than I would have liked to see.
Jack Beattie, what did you see on that stage? 10 candidates, many diverse views, people going after each other and after the sitting Republican president. A sign of strength, a sign of trouble.
Well, what I saw, first of all, was two more senators joined the We Did Not Read the National Intelligence Estimate Club before voting for the war on Iraq.
Senator Brownback and
John McCain.
John McCain, like
and
Hillary Clinton,
like
who was
Hillary,
sort of pilloried
like
for
Biden,
that.
Like mm-hmm. Edwards, like Dodd. Here was the major decision they ever would make in their lives, and they didn't trouble to read this 90-page document, which persuaded at least one senator to change his vote on Iraq. So it raises the question, why then did they all vote for this war? And I think we got a clue this week in Bob Shrum's autobiography, where he says that Edwards wanted to vote against it, but his political viability was at stake. So therefore, he had to vote for it to preserve his political viability.
But we're talking Republicans here, and they lined up pretty solid. But everybody said, Clinton and right on down said, I was thoroughly briefed. John McCain saying, I had thousands or hundreds or tens of hours of briefing on this. Let's hear some of the positions that were put out last night on the Iraq war, troublesome issue for Republicans in this race. Here's CNN's Wolf Blitzer asking the candidates, knowing what you know now, was it the right decision to go to war in Iraq? Here's former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney.
I supported the president's decision based on what we knew at that time. I think we were underprepared and underplanned for what came after we knocked down Saddam Hussein. By the way, Harry Reid was wrong. We did not lose the war in Iraq, and that's not the sort of thing you say when you have men and women in harm's way. We did, however, not do a great job after we knocked down Saddam Hussein and won the war to take him down and his military. And at this stage, the right thing for us to do is to see if we can possibly stabilize the central government in Iraq so that they can have stability and so we can bring our troops home as soon as possible.
Okay, and of course he said before all that, Diana Furstgott-Roth, that this is kind of a venture capitalist talk here. This was a null set question or non sequitur question. Wolf Blitzer came back at him saying, won't you answer it, though, knowing what we know now? And he repeated, this is a null set question. What did you think of Romney last night and on the war in particular, Diana?
Well, I think that he comes across as very presidential, and I think he has a lot of good positions. I think that we need to realize that Iran is funding a lot of the insurgency in Iraq. I think we need to realize they're also funding Hamas and Hezbollah, and we need to figure out what we're going to do about that. That's the big elephant in the room that no one is talking about enough.
Well, there was some talk last night, people ready to go potentially to nuclear war with Iran. Speaking of Romney, we have with us right now from Bedford, New Hampshire, Mark Halperin joining our crew here. He was at last night's debate in New Hampshire and at a big breakfast this morning for Mitt Romney. He's editor-at-large and political analyst for Time magazine, political analyst for ABC News, co-author of The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. Mark Halperin, thanks very much for joining us. What did you think of Romney last night and, for that matter, this morning?
Tom, he's had a very good couple weeks, the fundraising numbers and some rising poll numbers in key states. But it's a strange field. You've basically got four people at this point who could argue that they are the likely nominee, three people that you could argue are the front runners. Senator Thompson, when he does make this race, I don't think could argue he's the front runner, but his supporters are very bullish on their chances. Romney is a very consistent performer. The two things I'd say about him at this point, although I don't think last night was his best debate, is he's one of the most consistent performers I've ever seen in a presidential candidate, and he is the most organized person I've ever seen run for president. And I think those two things are paying off in the debates and in general.
He was pushing last night hard this Reagan-esque theme of optimism, though it sometimes seemed a kind of a clumsy grafting onto the flow of the debate. Does it work for him anyway, Mark?
Tom, you singled out an incredibly important part of the Romney candidacy. As any candidate has successes he's had, they're going to get more scrutiny. And one of the things is the question of, is he deft at dealing situationally with a crowd, with an interview, and the kind of optimism that he shows consistently is attractive to some voters, but it can at times sound a little bit off-key. He is so consistent. It is almost eerie, and of course some people react negatively to that and say he's robotic and he's a Ken Doll candidate. He's a very smart guy. He's a very organized guy. And if you're a campaign consultant or strategist, the last thing in the world you want is an inconsistent candidate. Both Rudy Giuliani and John McCain, and for that matter Fred Thompson, are extraordinarily inconsistent performers, and I think that's one of the advantages Romney takes into the summer and fall.
Yeah, well, there's more than performance going on here, Mark. This is Jack Beatty. Consistency is the one thing Romney doesn't have. Last night we found out another position he had shifted on, gays in the military from 1994. He has reinvented himself on one position after another.
He was for
another.
It then in 94 last night, saying we're just fine as it is, don't ask, don't tell.
Gun control, abortion, stem cell, whatever it is, he's flipped. So he's a model of inconsistency in terms of his position.
There's no question in terms of, I was talking simply about his performance as a debater and on the stump. There's no question the greatest vulnerability, there are twin vulnerabilities right now to this candidacy. One is his Mormon religion, his Mormon faith, which I thought he handled in the debate last night as well as he ever has. It was a short answer, but I thought the tone and the substance of that answer was quite striking and stronger than it's been. The other vulnerability is this series of changes of positions. But the Romney strategists will argue, as they do, that he's at least, from the point of view of the base of the party now, in the right place. If they are willing to accept the fact that he is a convert, if they believe that that's a true conversion and a heartfelt one, I think that they argue that he will be in a stronger place with the voters who decide this thing than John McCain, than Rudy Giuliani. And I believe, there's some possibility that those who argue the following are correct, which is, he changed his positions to become governor of Massachusetts, to run for the Senate against Ted Kennedy and lose, and then to become governor. He shifted to a more centrist and liberal set of positions. The positions he has now, many of which he held before, as best we can tell, before he ran for office in Massachusetts, are more conservative positions, and his true ones, and while that doesn't excuse the concept of flip-flopping and changing and doesn't remove all his vulnerability, it does put him in a better place, and it does allow him to argue the current positions, I think, with a little bit more force.
So he was against it or for it before he was for it or against it. A lot of voices last night. Let's hear some more here, again, on Wolf Blitzer's question about whether, knowing what we know now, invading Iraq was the right thing to do. Here's New York City former mayor Rudy Giuliani, not hesitating. Here's his answer.
Absolutely the right thing to do. It's unthinkable that you would leave Saddam Hussein in charge of Iraq and be able to fight the war on terror. And the problem is that we see Iraq in a vacuum. Iraq should not be seen in a vacuum. Iraq is part of the overall terrorist war against the United States. The problem the Democrats make is they're in denial. That's why you hear things like you heard in the debate the other night that, you know, Iran really isn't dangerous. It's 10 years away from nuclear weapons. Iran is not 10 years away from nuclear weapons. And the danger to us is not just missiles. The danger to us is a state like Iran handing nuclear weapons over to terrorists.
So it has to be seen in that light, and we have to be successful in Iraq.
So there's the little zap of lightning we heard throughout the debate last night. It was quite an incredible storm, but also the reference to Iran, which you brought up, Diana Furstadt-Roth, and on Iraq, Rudy Giuliani, on the record, on the stage, absolutely the right thing to do. Diana, how does that work politically when we look at the numbers about how unpopular this war has become, even among Republicans?
Well, I think that it's good to see somebody standing up for their positions, and I think the American people admire that. I also think that the American people want to get out of this war, but they want to get out of it victorious. They don't want to just walk off and leave, and the headlines that would follow that would be a lot worse than what we have right now. So I think that that's a point in Giuliani's favor. He's not flip-flopping. He's consistent. And the biggest danger we're going to be having in the next 2 to 4 to 6 years is dealing with the war on terrorism. I think people see Giuliani as a tough leader.
There was a lot of lightning, zips and zaps. We heard them all night. Here's Arizona Senator John McCain, strong supporter of the Iraq War and the surge, speaking directly to an audience member in the second half of the debate, a New Hampshire woman who lost her brother in Iraq.
Ma'am, I want to tell you thank you for your brother's service and sacrifice to our country. We are proud of you and your endurance, and we're proud of his sacrifice. This war, I'm going to give you a little straight talk. This war was very badly mismanaged for a long time, and Americans have made great sacrifices, some of which were unnecessary because of this mismanagement of this conflict. I believe we have a fine general. I believe we have a strategy which can succeed, so that the sacrifice of your brother would not be in vain. That a whole 20 or 30 million people would have a chance to live a free life in an open society and practice their religion, no matter what those differences are. And I believe if we fail, it will become a center of terrorism. And we will ask more young Americans to sacrifice as your brother did. This is long and hard and tough, but I think we can succeed, and God bless you.
John McCain standing up with an emotional appeal to a woman who lost her brother in Iraq at the debate last night. Mark Halpern, what I saw up there was, it seemed, Republicans kind of all over the map on Iraq. Tommy Thompson, have them vote if we should stay or not. Brownback, break it into three parts. McCain, can't afford to lose, long and hard and tough, we heard him right there. Gilbert, train up Iraqi forces and get out. Ron Paul, gadfly, but if no progress in September, come home. Tancredo, if the surge isn't working, tell them, using Benjamin Franklin's words, we've given you a republic. If you can keep it, good luck. We're out of here come September. What, Mark?
Tom, that was an excellent summary of the voices that we heard last night, largely from the minor candidates in the Republican Party, the ones whose voices are important but whose electoral prospects aren't that strong. I think when President Bush, as many people anticipate, changes course in some way in September, again, perhaps the surge will have worked, the influx of troops will have worked, but if he does change course, you will hear a lot of relief on the part of Senator McCain, for sure, and probably Giuliani and Romney. Their strategists believe that the party has, the brand of the party is taking a lot of hits because of the Iraq War. And then that new direction, if President Bush embarks on one, is going to involve not just the Bush administration, but Republicans in Congress and on Capitol and on the presidential trail looking for an answer of what people propose. It's been easy for the Republican Party in one sense because everyone has just stood with the White House. That is, from Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, to many other Republicans, it's clear that there's going to be a thousand flowers blooming, a lot of voices in the party, and I think the presidential candidates reflect a lot of the ideas, and of course many of those ideas are similar from what you hear from the Democrats. So there is a chance, not an absolute probability, but a chance that come the voting in Iowa and New Hampshire, this issue of the difference between the parties on Iraq may not be nearly as stark as it is now.
Maybe, depending what happens. But as you say, we heard a lot, maybe among the secondary candidates in particular. But that was a lot of diversity compared to the Democrats. Basically, we want out of there. A lot of diversity on immigration as well. Let's listen to some of those voices from last night. Front and center topic, leading the charge against the McCain-Kennedy bill was the Colorado Congressman Tom Tancredo.
What we're doing here in this immigration battle is testing our willingness to actually hold together as a nation or split apart into a lot of balkanized pieces. We are testing our willingness to actually hold on to something called the English language, something that is the glue that is supposed to hold us together as a nation. We are becoming a bilingual nation, and that is not good.
New York's Mayor Rudy Giuliani slammed the McCain-Kennedy bill, calling it a typical Washington mess.
The problem with this immigration plan is it has no real unifying purpose. It's a typical Washington mess. It's everybody compromises, four or five compromises, and the compromises leave you with the following conclusion. The litmus test you should have for legislation is it going to make things better? And when you look at these compromises, it is quite possible it will make things worse.
And then here's Arizona Senator John McCain. His name is on it. He defended the immigration bill.
This is a national security issue, first and foremost. Ever since 9/11, it's a national security issue. People came to Fort Dix, New Jersey, from across our southern border and tried to kill our soldiers. For us to do nothing is silent and de facto amnesty. What we have done is what you expect us to do, my friends, and that's come together with the President of the United States, the leader of our party, Democrat and Republican, conservative Republicans like John Kyle, Johnny Isaacson, Saxby Chambliss, and Trent Lott, and sit down and figure out an approach to this problem. And it is a serious national security problem. We need to act, my friends. And if someone else has a better idea, I'd love to have them pursue give
Thank
it
you.
To us.
Thank you, Senator. Hold on.
John McCain last night on immigration, and it looked like a Grand Canyon on this topic. Diana Furstgott-Roth, I mean, here, right into the heart of the sort of core candidates, big gulfs.
Well, it's a great problem for the Republican Party because there is this great gulf, and I think the Republican Party needs to do something about it because because the anti-immigrant camp is basically turning away the Hispanic vote. In 2000, the Republican Party got a lot of the Hispanic vote. 2006, a lot less because of the different anti-immigration positions. And I think the Republican Party needs to get together and think, what are we going to do with these 12 million people who are here? And what's a sensible, workable solution? And I think that the comprehensive immigration bill put out by the Senate takes a stab at that. It has a 24-hour period where someone would apply to get an ID number, then would get a kind of preliminary Z visa. Then afterwards, there would be an extensive background check background check were passed.
And we heard all that last night asserted again and again by McCain. This isn't an easy path to citizenship, and yet absolutely slammed by others up there, and even Rudy Giuliani calling this, Mark, a mess.
Tom, this is a huge story, not just in the presidential campaign, but on Capitol Hill and also around the country. I think, if I can bumper sticker the lesson I think we can currently see here, it's that demagoguery and emotion trump bipartisan compromise and rational thought. And John McCain is being left out there by himself, basically alone. Senator Brownback is sort of lukewarm in favor of the bill. But amongst the top Republican candidates, he's out there by himself. The other candidates are enjoying his excruciating pain. And I have been struck by the failure of the White House, of the Republican National Committee, of the business community, of other elements of the Republican Party who could get together to do what they think is right, to pass a bill like the Senate bill, but also by at least indirectly, to help Senator McCain. You're not seeing that, and that's another issue. There's talk now that the bill will be pulled from the Senate and would basically, I think, be dead for the duration of the Bush administration. That is another issue where Senator McCain's political strategist, at least, would not be sorry to see it go.
Jack Beattie,
They're talking about, if I could just say, that the anti-bill people are talking about are problems inherent in the structure of America. They're saying, well, immigrants will go on welfare. The problem is welfare. Well, if that's so, we should attack the welfare structure. They're talking about bilingual education. Well, we don't have to have bilingual education. This is not a problem of immigration per se.
Maybe not, but it sure looked like a problem. Let's start to hear from our listeners, if we may. David's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and
Hi.
Jack. Good to be here. I want to take issue with the shibboleth repeated by your panelist from the Manhattan Institute and several of the news people.
That would be the Hudson Institute, Diana Furstgott-Roth. What do you mean?
She worries about how the impossibility, supposedly, of rounding up and deporting 12 million illegal immigrants. To paraphrase Field of Dreams, if you don't give them jobs, they will leave. It's as simple as that. If we had enforced the law that was laid down in the 1986 amnesty, we wouldn't have this problem because they wouldn't be able to get jobs.
So you say dry up the ocean, they'll go away. Who was singing your tune then on that stage last night, David?
I confess I didn't watch it, but I'm sure that Congressman Tancredo was singing it.
It's sort of Governor Romney's position. What's interesting...
He did explicitly say, let's enforce the 1986 laws.
Yeah. You know, I would say if one were to be critical of the Bush administration on immigration, one of the things I would seize on is there have been almost no prosecution of employers. And, of course, part of the dirty little secret here is the business community doesn't want to keep careful records because they need the workers. And, of course, from a consumer point of view, the American economy in many states and many industries would shut down if it were not for the illegal labor. So if people believe that the solution, as the caller does, is to shut down the employers, to raid companies, to fine them heavily, maybe criminal prosecutions if they hire illegal aliens, the question's going to be, is Governor Romney and others, are they correct, that you can, in a smooth transition, replace those workers, those illegal workers, with legal workers and keep the economy moving?
But there's one that goes to the heart of the GOP base. CNN's Wolf Blitzer asked former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee last night, what's happened to the GOP? Huckabee had this answer.
Lost credibility because we didn't do what we were hired to do. When you're elected, you're hired to do a job. You're hired to cut spending, lower taxes, bring more government back to the local people. We did the polar opposite. And the people fired us. And I think in many ways, there were some good people that got caught up in the tsunami of the 2006 elections. The Republican Party as a whole deserved to get beat. We've lost credibility. The way we bungled Katrina, the fact that there was corruption that was unchecked in Washington, and the fact that there was a feeling that there was not a proper handling of the Iraqi war and all of these details, and the indifference to people pouring over our borders.
Boy, there's a big checklist, and we'll look at it. Mary's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. You know, all this talk about the 12 million is sounding too much like the Voluntary Conference that was held in 1942 to decide the final solution.
You're talking about the 12 million illegal immigrants, and then you're looking back to Germany in World War II.
Yes, they talked about the 6 million. And then now are we looking for the final solution? These candidates need to get it together. I believe we're living in Nazi Germany in 1930s anyway. But when you fall so low, And never ask them the question to themselves, how did these immigrants rise to 12 million? They must have had a welcome mat, or somebody had the door open.
Yeah, a lot of jobs being done, though we heard Sam Brownback saying, you know, take them out of a meatpacking plant in, what was it, Iowa or Nebraska, and you'll have Americans lining up to take their jobs right behind them. Mary, thanks very much for your call. Diana Ferscott-Roth, what about that litany from Mike Huckabee? And he wasn't the only one. I mean, there was some real uncomfortable public soul-searching about what's happened with the GOP up there last night.
Well, I think it's always easy to point the finger at a party that has the presidency, the Senate, and the House, and there's always going to be mistakes made. But if you look at the GOP's economic record, it hasn't done such a bad job. We have low unemployment.
But we're not asking you to defend the GOP. We're asking you to look at the candidates for president and what they were saying last night. And they were extremely critical.
Well, they're extremely critical because Bush has low approval ratings now. And so if they run against President Bush, they're hoping to get support.
Yeah.
I mean, their politicians...
Well, you don't think their criticism is genuine? You don't think it's... you don't really take it seriously?
Well, I think the biggest criticism is that Bush hasn't cut spending enough. And it's not completely his fault because he has sent bills up to Congress. And Congress just continues to send back budgets that are larger than the president requests in terms of discretionary spending. So I think spending has ballooned, and we really need to do something about that. And Republicans came in with a promise to lower taxes and cut spending. They've lowered taxes. They haven't cut spending. But in terms of the corruption, there's corruption that goes on under all administrations. And as we saw from the events in Louisiana a couple of days ago, it's not just limited to Republicans.
Mark Halperin, let me ask you. I mean, here we had, again, not just the marginal candidates, but McCain, as Diana says, spending out of control was his big critique. Rudy Giuliani, no accountability in this period in Washington. It's a mess, he says. Romney, you know, we've gotten too small bore. Thompson, Washington changed us. We didn't change Washington, and right on down Tancredo. Is this just posturing against an unpopular president, or is this a genuine, heartfelt critique of what's happened to these candidates' party?
Well, I think in almost every case it's both genuine and seen as politically advantageous. But notice that with the exception of Tom Tancredo, who's had a big run-in with the White House on immigration, these candidates are talking about the president's policies. They're not making it personal, and that's because they talk to Republican voters in focus groups and out on the trail, and they know that people in the party still respect the president. They still like him. But they do have real questions about the war, in some cases, about spending, about corruption, about confidence in the administration over Katrina. So they're trying to define themselves. They're trying to define the party and themselves as leaders of a post-Bush Republican party. And they're also, I think, have at least a part of one eye on the general election, where they're going to have to appeal to independents. While the president's support amongst Republicans is down, it is with independents and Republican-leaning independents where it's really cratered, and where going into a general election, whoever the nominees are, the Republicans are going to have some ground to make up. And I think they're beginning that process, but I don't think they're making positions up. And if anything, I think they've been a little bit slow to speak how they really feel in private, in talking to leading Republicans, including some longtime Bush loyalists, close to both 41 and 43, and people who you don't normally hear speak negatively about Republicans at all. You hear a lot of negative talk, and I think the candidates are reflecting the reality of that.
Jack Beatty, hard to do a kind of soul-searching house cleaning and put a new candidate up for the next round at the same time, or is this what's necessary after 8 years of a party in power?
It's necessary. Fred Thompson last week in a speech in Virginia said, you know, we went into the swamp, we had to clean the swamp, and we decided to stay and play with the alligators. And you know, that seems to be the line, that we're going to have a new beginning. We're going to go back to 1994, or to what we promised in 1994 with the Republican Revolution, and we're going to have a new time of reform. And I think they have to say that, and they've got to somehow give earnests of that, in order to do anything in the general election. I think we're going to hear a lot about that from them, about the idea that the Republican Party is a party of reform understood in their terms.
Mm. We're talking about the Republicans in debate, 10 GOP presidential candidates lined up last night in New Hampshire. Here's former Virginia Governor James Gilmore. He's made some hay by lumping the top three candidates together with his phrase, Rudy McRomney. He was asked if former Senator Fred Thompson officially enters the race, would he change the phrase to Rudy McRomney's son?
Well, we've gotten a little mileage out of Rudy McRomney. I know the mayor one time said that it would make a good ticket, and it would, but it isn't a conservative ticket. And we don't know what Fred Thompson is either. Now, I think he's a fine man. He served in the Senate a term and a half. Let's see exactly what his views are. I'm coming forward and offering my views as a 40-year battler for conservative values and conservative principles on behalf of the people of the United States. And I have the record to back it up.
Take that, Fred Thompson. Step up if you want to play. Let's go to Rich in Columbia, South Carolina. Rich, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Listen, I just think that I want to be the amen corner for the reality of people finally exposing some of the stinky skeletons in the closet. I agree with Fred Thompson's assessment that some of these guys really are bozos. I know, as one of the Republican base, that we are tired of all the politicking, and we're looking for people to be straightforward and just tell it like it is and be willing to acknowledge where the failures have been and quit trying to smooth talk or sweeten the deal.
Yeah, Rich, who sounded then straightforward to you last night?
I think the honest issue is it comes down to particular issues. McCain definitely was straightforward, even though I don't necessarily agree with a lot of what he says. At least he's standing up to his guns. That's the only thing about Bush that I really can support. I do agree with Tancredo in a lot of degrees, but to be honest, for me, the jury's still out, and I'm highly skeptical, and I'm looking forward to the crowd thinning out quite a bit.
But bring on the straight talk, the tough talk, even if it's self-critical talk. It's time for that, you say, as a Republican. Jack, Diana, Mark, let's talk about these front runners. I mean, in the polls here, as you say, Mark, they're kind of all over the place. We had USA Today June 1 to 3 with Gallup had Rudy Giuliani at 32%, John McCain 19%, Mitt Romney 12%, and then Fred Thompson and Newt Gingrich coming in right behind. This new Rasmussen poll just out before the debate has Romney edging ahead of McCain. But what did we see in the front runners last night? What Giuliani, what did you see there, Mark?
Well, look, it's an extraordinary, an unprecedented situation. The Republican Party, you normally have one person who is the buzz front runner, the money front runner, the polling front runner, and the establishment front runner. That's been the case every cycle in the modern history. Now, Thompson has the buzz, McCain has the establishment, Giuliani has the polling for the most part, Romney has the money. You know, these guys are all credible, as I said at the beginning, credible nominees. Giuliani, I thought, was strong. I thought he had some moments where he looked more presidential than he has, as subjective as that may be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he got off the hook when the lightning struck the building, because he was able to turn what could have been a very confrontational moment over a Catholic bishop in Rhode Island's criticism of his position on abortion into a light moment. But at the same time, he has not been challenged. It's a very interesting question percolating up here in New Hampshire, where I am, which is, why are the Romney campaign and the McCain campaign relatively soft on Rudy Giuliani in the debates? And I think that we may begin to see that change, because up until now they thought it was useful for him to take up space. I don't think they think that anymore.
Jack, how about Giuliani? I mean, I look at him, he's got this kind of simple, crisp clarity, very lucid way of speaking and thinking, even if you disagree with his thinking on a particular issue. He looks like an old-fashioned leader with those kind of wire-rimmed glasses and a little hunch, his glint and hunch, of that kind of Truman-y, Teddy Roosevelt look and feel to Giuliani.
I think that's what he's trying for, and when he knocked the all the compromises going on in Washington, he voiced the plain man's feeling about Washington. My gosh, all they do is make sausage down there, and I want to go down and take care of things. On the other hand, that impatience with parliamentary compromise sort of plays to the other feeling about Giuliani, that there's an authoritarian streak in him. And that's what he really, that every time he talks about, oh, they're making too many compromises and so on, I'm afraid he feeds a little bit on that. And we can't get away from the fact that these three men each seem to, I didn't hear McCain, but I heard the other two, accept the idea that we would have a nuclear strike at a country that did not have nuclear weapons. That is a moral red line we have never contemplated crossing.
You're talking about Iran and its push for nuclear weapons. Everybody believes. We'll come to that and to McCain. But, Diana, I want to get your response to this exchange between Wolf Blitzer and Kansas Senator Sam Brownback, talking about Giuliani here. Brownback talked about the value of human life, lots of conversation about that last night, and bluntly said Giuliani's positions on abortion make him the wrong choice for the GOP nomination.
I have great respect for the mayor. I don't think we're going to nominate somebody that's not pro-life.
Would you be able to support him?
I can support and will support the nominee of our party. But our party has stood on principles. It's a party of principles. It's not a party of personalities.
Thank you,
we lose when we walk away from our principles.
There it is. Diana, what about it? Can Giuliani get past that with the Republican base that will come out to select a nominee?
I think that the Republican base is going to look at what's important in the future years coming up, and the war with Iran and with Iraq, the conflict, terrorism, those are important issues in the minds of Americans.
Did you say Iran? What war with Iran are you speaking of?
Iran is funding, we're not at war with Iran, but Iran is funding the insurgents. It's funding the IEDs in Iraq that are attacking and blowing up our troops.
And for the base, you think that will overshadow what the candidates presented as a core issue, life, abortion?
Well, I think that war is going to dominate the agenda, and it's very likely that within the next 2 years, I hope not, but al-Qaeda has repeatedly says it's going to attack us, and I think the next attack on U.S. soil can very much change people's minds. Because, like it or not, whatever the candidates say about abortion, they're not going to really manage to change the status quo very much, but they are going to have a lot of effect on what we do in terms of our foreign policy, what we do to fight terrorism, and the first job of a president is protecting the people of the United States. I was in the White House on September 11th, 2001, and let me tell you, it was panic, and people thought there was going to be further attacks the next few days. We're very lucky that didn't happen.
We all saw 9/11, and it's huge, and Rudy Giuliani and others positioning themselves very strongly, saying, we've got a long, long war here, and Democrats don't get the scale of it. That's clearly a big theme last night. Let's go to Devin in Norwich, Connecticut. Devin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question goes directly to that, then. If we're really interested in national security and protecting our people, how can multiple candidates endorse the idea of preemptive nuclear strikes? I mean, what more moral ground, high ground, do we need to surrender to al-Qaeda when we're talking about preemptive nuclear action, nuclear weapons.
But what if let me ask you, Devin, in particular, what if it's to stop Iran from becoming armed with nuclear weapons? Still off the board in your view?
Absolutely. I mean, if you have nuclear weapons are like the end-all, be-all of becoming a first-rate civilization in the world, everybody wants them. Are we going to nuke everybody if they want nuclear weapons? I mean, if anybody else wants to develop nuclear weapons, civilian power nuclear weapons, it's not, I mean, there isn't a big difference.
Yeah.
Iran probably does want a nuclear bomb for their own national security. But how can we discuss actually preemptively using weapons of mass destruction?
Devin, we'll pick it up, but let's listen first to the one man on the stage last night who might be in the same camp as you there. The candidates were all asked by a college philosophy professor at St. Anselm's, where the debate was held, about the biggest moral challenge facing the country. Here's Texas Congressman, kind of an outlier here, no question, but here's Ron Paul.
I think it is the acceptance just recently that we now promote preemptive war. I do not believe that's part of the American tradition.
There's Ron Paul last night. Let's go to Les in Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Les. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. I'm listening to the entire conversation and having watched the two previous debates as well, it strikes me very much to the core that real conservative values, such as those posed by Ron Paul, are very much swept under the rug. This gentleman, who had two stellar performances in the first two debates, came in third in the Drudge Report poll after the first debate.
Yeah, but he's nowhere in the polls. Do you say this as a conservative, Les, or as a critic of the GOP, or both, or what?
I was originally a conservative, Republican, Reagan-Bush conservative. Was disingenuous with the Democrats, and now I'm disgusted, pretty much with the Republicans. And Ron Paul has, for everyone that has had an opportunity to see this gentleman, strikes a chord both in Democrats, Independents, and Republicans. And the fact that he was specifically marginalized in this third debate because he did so well in the first two debates, especially with regards to bringing out the light issues with regards to 9/11, and the fact that Giuliani wasn't even taken to task in this debate to answer with regards to, the blowback issue with regards to, they're just not, out there attacking us because,
Have we made more trouble than we've solved here? Les, let us pick it up. Jack Beattie, I don't know that Ron Paul was marginalized last night. I thought he got a fair bit of attention from Wolf Blitzer. And it's interesting, in both the Republican and Democratic debates, these marginal candidates really do mix it up just as theater, if nothing else, and maybe a lot more. But what about this kind of voice in the wilderness on that Republican stage?
Well, that is a voice in the wilderness, and the comparable one is Dennis Kucinich for the Democrats. Yep. And isn't it something that the two people who had the wit and the sagacity to vote against this war when they were in Congress, Kucinich and Paul, are the total outliers in their race. No chance. Ron Paul, I every time he talks about foreign policy, and especially when he talks about taxes and foreign policy and reminds voters that's what we're carrying, this vast burden of our military establishment, I shake my head and say that's a man making sense. But if you get him on things like Social Security or the gold standard, that he's a big man for the gold standard.
Here we go.
Suddenly you realize that Ron is an eccentric politically, that's for sure.
Let's go to Catherine in Leominster, Massachusetts. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I listened to both the debates, and I'm also really kind of curious about the fact that your panel seems to be ignoring what, or not really speaking to, a comment which puts it together for me. When the senator talked about that they apologizing that they went to clean up the swamp, but they stayed, with the alligators, is like saying, well, I'm just now waking up that we were wrong and that these people are not being held accountable for just allowing things to get to this state. Like, they didn't do the right thing. They just went with their party. It's like people now criticizing the Democrats, those who changed their mind about the war. It seems really kind of odd. I would like you
Well, Rudy Giuliani said the lack of accountability in Republican Washington had been a major problem. Did that begin to scratch the itch you're expressing there, Catherine?
Well, it just seems like I'm surprised people are not jumping all over that. It's like, now I'm just waking up from a bad hangover and, I'm going to do something different.
Yep. Mark Halperin, how about it? This comes back to the sort of self-criticism that some Americans are still looking for the amplitude to be picked up on in the GOP?
Well, I mean, part of the problem is people like your well-informed listeners are paying attention. The most people aren't. And these candidates, with the exception of Senator McCain, we're looking at a field of first-time presidential candidates, and they're still learning how to do this. And they're doing it sporadically under spotlights like the debates. But for the most part, one of my overall criticisms of the fields on both sides is that they don't, I don't think in too many cases, have fully formed plans, fully thought through agendas the way Bill Clinton and George W. Bush did when they first ran for president. And I think you see the spillover effects of that in all sorts of ways, including the caller's frustration.
Here's a little bit from Representative Duncan Hunter on the Republican Party, California congressman, staunch social conservative, talking about restoring Republican Party's old values.
The Republican Party has to reunite with the American family and pass policies that are constant with the American family. Then we'll be a great party again.
Diana Furstgott-Roth, an interesting twist on that he made was, though, saying we have to support the middle class. This hasn't exactly been a big clarion call, not where they've sort of made their chops in the minds of many people. Is Duncan Hunter on to something there, trying to, reach back to the middle class in a time when we've seen income inequality growing and all that?
Well, it's not clear, first of all, that income inequality has been growing because the middle class has been prospering. Everybody is doing better than they were 5 or 10 years ago. But I think that some of the candidates focused on, not so much in this last debate, but previously, is how they plan to extend the Bush tax cuts, which, if nothing happens, are just going to expire in 2010. And I think that appealed to the middle class. Governor Romney has gone beyond that and says he's going to make taxes even lower than President Bush did this year. And I think all of that is going to appeal to the middle class. Middle class values of work ethic, also kind of cutting the corruption in Washington because the middle class gets to keep more of the money and Congress doesn't have it, which I think is very appealing to the middle class.
I think I heard a little different spin from Hunter last night, but fair enough. Well, our time grows short. I want to think about John McCain for a minute here. I mean, at the beginning last night, of course, he was the great straight talker in previous campaigns. At the beginning last night seemed to me kind of sad and slow, but then, once he gets revved up, he brings in a pretty big gun. It feels deep, experienced, real, even wise, Mark Halperin, and yet people are beginning to write him off. How do you see the McCain campaign?
Tom, I try never to habitually suck up to the host, but once again, I think you're right on. He did start slow, and it's a bit of a metaphor. Stylistically, what you see is what you get with John McCain. What they're counting on is weathering some more bad news. I mean, they're not going to have the best fundraising this year. That seems clear. That's unusual for a Republican frontrunner. He may well be challenged and not do well at this straw poll event in Iowa in August. Of course, immigration and Iraq will continue to bedevil his candidacy, at least for a little bit. What they're counting on is that when the voters actually start to vote, whatever candidates are left in the field, when we get to January or perhaps December, that voters will turn to the experienced candidate, the one who may not be the sunniest, the one who may not be the youngest, but the one who is, as he says, the most experienced. And they recognize, a lot of chatter up here, that people are saying he's dead, that his candidacy is dead. They say that's not true. They'll weather the additional tough days, and they'll be in there, and they'll win it.
Jack Beatty, hope for the wise old guy here?
Well, when he says, I have served my country my whole life, he's calling on something that Republicans admire, a life like that, and his service record. And when he says people don't act, when you look at the Vietnam War Memorial, you see Hispanic names there. When you go to Iraq, you see kids with green cards. This is America. I think Republicans understand that that's true, too. He's tapping at basic emotional chords, I think, among the Republican electorate. They may not be acknowledging it now, but I think it's there for him somewhere.
And when immigration's under attack last night on that stage, he responds, muchas gracias. That takes the nerve of maybe a former soldier. I want to thank each of you for being with us. Diana Furstgott-Roth at the New York Sun, terrific to have you. Thanks for being here, Diana.
Thank you.
And Mark Halperin with Time Magazine and ABC News. Mark, always great to have you on. Thanks for joining us today.
Tom, thanks so much.
Jack Beatty, good to have you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.